welcome to the ESG Factor podcast, brought to you by ESG Ireland and the Institute of Banking. This series focuses on the practical integration of environmental, social and governance, or ESG factors, hence the name, the ESG Factor. In this series, we'll have in-depth interviews with those working across ESG and equities, bonds, property and hedge funds, and we'll tell you a little bit more about that at the end of the episode. This episode is starting a discussion on the integration of ESG within fixed income. So, Vincent, I'm going to hand over to you now. Do you want to tell the listeners a little bit more about today's podcast and in particular why it's important as it is?
Thanks, Eimear. Well, first of all, I think when trustees and advisors think about ESG, they tend to think about it in terms of adding an ESG fund, essentially kind of ticking the box. We've ticked the ESG box by adding a fund. But what I would say to advisors and trustees is that you have to take ESG a lot more seriously. And it applies right across asset classes. So it's about building more robust portfolios. And when we talk about fixed income bonds, it tends to be the one area that can confuse trustees and advisors. I had one trustee previously who worked in a bank, and explaining to him the inverse relationship of interest rates and bonds got confusing. So that will tell you how confusing it is for the average individual. Bonds, basically, if you think of it at the very basic level, is just like a loan. So when you put money into the bank, you're lending money to the bank and they're paying a specific interest rate. Now, interest rates are very low across the world, so it's very hard to earn interest. But in terms of bonds, you've got corporate bonds, government bonds, you've got mortgage-backed securities, which are like loans against properties. So bonds is a massive market, and it's a hugely important part of portfolios. So when we want to talk about ESG, we don't want to just talk about adding an ESG fund. We want to talk about integrating ESG right across all asset classes. And so today we're very lucky to have on a leader in this field in global fixed income from a responsible investing perspective. Ashley Shulton is the managing director of BlackRock in New York, the world's largest asset manager. Ashley is the head of responsible investing for global fixed income. She's also a portfolio manager on global green and socially responsible mandates. And she works with the teams within BlackRock in terms of integrating ESG and climate risk into their strategies. So, Ashley, really delighted to have you on the podcast here today. I have two questions to start with. First, did I leave anything out? Because you've got a wealth of experience to share. And two, I did also notice that you were an options trader previously. So some people might be thinking options, very short term. And the world we're in, responsible investing is all about thinking long term. So you might have some insights on that.
Thank you for having me. This is a topic that I'm really pleased to speak on. On my options background, I think, you know, my background has been around 20 plus years in fixed income. And I came to the ESG space around 5 years ago, having traded options. And I think one of the things that caused me to come into this space was the fact that as an options trader, you're always looking for mispriced risk. And when we start to think about climate risk and how climate risk impacts portfolios, I really felt strongly that was a mispriced risk and something that I didn't think markets were taking into account. And that intellectually for me, it was a fascinating topic to work on. So although it may seem like a disconnect to think about an options trader, and I actually also traded gamma, which is very short dated options.
Yeah.
I do think that there is a connection to why I was drawn to the space.
Yeah, and I think that is the thing about ESG and responsible investing for anyone that actually really does delve into it. It is an intellectually challenging area because you are testing a lot of your existing beliefs. And what we've seen is that ESG over the last few years really has gathered huge momentum. It is kind of the topic of the day. And before we get into the fixed income side of it, what do you think are the kind of main drivers for ESG becoming so prevalent across the discussions?
Yeah, I would say that there are a number of factors that have led really to what I would say is an explosion of interest in ESG. I think the first is that company balance sheets are changing. And so now more than ever, we have a lot of intangibles on company balance sheets like brand, reputation. And so we need to think about new ways of doing credit research that are not the same tools that perhaps we used 5 years ago. Another thing is that society's changing. You know, I would argue that we are going through a sustainability revolution. And so that means a change in consumer preferences. And I think also that companies are being asked to take stands on social issues in a way that they haven't in the past. And this has implications for their valuations. So that's another thing that we really need to, as investors, you know, be aware of, that this movement is having implications on the financials for companies. I think another thing that is, I would say, a watershed moment was the Paris Climate Agreement. And so here you have the majority of countries in the world coming together saying, basically, we're going to be carbon neutral by 2050. That is zero carbon by 2050. And so think about the implications for that. I mean, those are massive, massive changes in our energy mix. And so you're either acknowledging that we're going to go through this big transition, or, you know, on the other side, that we're not, and that we are setting ourselves up for significant physical impacts of climate change. So that's something that investors have to acknowledge. And I think lastly, one of the things I think that has been a game changer in markets is the development of ESG ratings. If you're going to do an ESG analysis on a portfolio of five names, you can go and do all the deep dives and read all the sustainability reports for companies and, you know, really flush out some of these nuances. But what if you have a portfolio of 500 names? And I think for a lot of investors, you know, a few years ago, where do you even start? And so the rollout of ratings, and I know there's criticism in the market that they're not perfect, but the old adage, you manage what you measure, I think is really appropriate here. And whenever you can put a metric on something, then you really start to flesh out differences. So I think that has really helped the incorporation of this new type of new lens of looking at investing in the market.
Yeah.
And Ashley, I might ask you a very quick question just on the society's changing mindset on sustainability and ESG in general. Do you have a view about the demographics involved in that? A lot of the it's almost a simplistic view of it is that it's the younger, perhaps the millennial mindset that is driving it rather than it being across society. Do you have any views on that?
So the studies show that that it's millennials and women that prioritize sustainability right now. But I will tell you that I think that we are definitely evolving on this topic. I think, you know, 5 years ago, climate change was not on the radar for most mainstream investors. And now anybody that's not looking at climate change in portfolio is not a good investor. And so while it may have started from that demographic, I think it is really rolling into across all investors. I think also, too, you're seeing regulators push on this. And so whether you believe it or not, you're going to be forced to be reporting on this and being explaining about how you're taking this into account.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think the intangibles point is extremely important that, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you could value a company based on its real assets. Whereas right now, you're talking, by some measures, it could be 80, 85% of a company's value is its intangibles. So I suppose we're well aware of that from an equity valuation perspective. But then as we come into fixed income, you know, BlackRock has been very clear that we need a differentiated approach to sustainable investing in fixed income, is what they say. So as you think now, ESG equities took the lead, now fixed income is catching up. What are you seeing in terms of the application across that fixed income spectrum?
Yeah, so when we think about the differences in ESG approaches in equities and fixed income, and oftentimes, I mean, we're looking at the same companies. And the same environmental and social issues that we care about oftentimes in the equity space, those are the same things we care about in fixed income. So it's not that we're necessarily looking for different topics. I think that in the equity space, there may have been an earlier focus on this. And I think some of that may have been driven by the fact as an equity holder that you vote proxies. And oftentimes you're seeing environmental and social issues come up in proxy votes. So it may have been an issue for the equity space a little bit earlier. But I would say now there is just as much emphasis on fixed income as there is on equities on this topic. It's a little bit of a different challenge in fixed income because we are looking at investment instruments that are not just company debt. So as you mentioned earlier, you know, we need to think about incorporating ESG in sovereign space, in quasi-sovereign space, in securitized like mortgages and commercial mortgages. And so that requires a little bit of a different approach. But I think the themes resonate across the different asset classes within fixed income.
And before we get into kind of the mechanics of looking at ESG integration across various elements of the fixed income spectrum, what I do think is interesting is when we think about bonds in portfolios, we're talking typically the safe assets that are in there as an instrument to kind of balance out the risk that you're taking in equity. So typically, you know, you look at pension schemes, insurers, they're kind of their matching liabilities. They're there as the kind of safer assets. And they tend to have a long-term horizon. So, you know, these bonds are longer term. So for me, when I'm reading the stuff that says, you know what, sustainability-related risks in bonds makes perfect sense because it's a long-term asset. And ultimately, there's no point in looking back at the last 15 or 20 years. We have to look forward for the next 10, 15 years and the risks, climate risks, societal challenge, etc., that could materially impact the value of that bond, that par value.
Yeah, I think there is an acknowledgement that that ESG risks sometimes are going to take a long time to play out. I think this is especially true when you think about physical climate risk. Some of the modeling that we're doing on physical climate risk, and we're looking at impacts in 2040, 2050, 2060. But that is in the horizon of some fixed income investments. But I think, you know, it's interesting to think about the long-term investor and step back and talk about the spectrum of ESG. And so, you know, when we think about ESG integration, we're thinking about what is the impact on our portfolios from environmental and social issues? And so what is the financial implication on our portfolios from some of these topics? And that is, you know, the impact on portfolios. But certainly in the ESG spectrum, and you hear this more and more, even from institutional investors, is that there is an interest in the impact of portfolios on the world. And so you're thinking about not only what is my financial return on this portfolio, but what are maybe some additional returns that I'm getting, whether I'm funding clean energy or I'm funding microfinance, et cetera. And when you think about the long-term investor, you know, if you're really investing for a 30-year horizon, what you're really thinking about is that impact of the portfolio really rolling back over that time in terms of the impact on the portfolio. And I think that's especially true around climate change. If you're thinking about a 50-year horizon, you are concerned about what climate change looks like in 50 years. You are looking at what forward GDP looks like. You are looking at your risk to emerging markets, what is, you know, the, which in a lot of climate models will have negative GDP implications on a forward basis if we don't do something now to act on climate change. And so that's, I think, where an interesting nexus comes together is that, you know, I think previously we've thought about ESG, the lens of ESG being about risk and return on our financial returns. And then the other side of it, which I think we previously called impact investing, thinking about, you know, the do-gooder. Well, actually, I think those worlds are colliding. And you think about what are things that we can do now with investments that will future-proof our ability to have positive returns in the future.
Certainly, I think that comes back to the education side of things, because once you kind of go down that route of looking at the impact of the portfolio from an E or an S, from an environmental or a social perspective, you're taking a more, I suppose, a more holistic view of the world that we live in. So you're not looking at just a portfolio as a financial instrument. You're actually taking into consideration the wider system that we're all part of. And I suppose there's an element of that, your values, what do you stand for? And do you kind of, you almost have to educate the asset owners, the trustees, the advisors, and say, by actually incorporating these values or understanding the impact of the portfolio, you're inadvertently actually helping the long-term risk-adjusted returns of your portfolio. So it's not mutually exclusive, the relationship.
Yeah, and I think that the term that the market is sort of coalesced around is this concept of the universal owner. So these are, you know, the very large, like you mentioned, pension funds that you cannot take a scalpel and go into your portfolio and carve out your risk here. You are exposed. You are a long-term holder. You're exposed across different, you know, asset classes, across different markets, and you are going to be exposed to the economic implications of some of these themes. And so that's, you know, the messaging that you hear about measuring externalities often comes from those larger, what we call universal owners. And I think, you know, in fixed income, that's why I think the concept of green bonds has really been so popular. You know, this is an instrument that is not around taking a scalpel and carving out the climate risk. This is really an impact product that's thinking about, you know, the use of proceeds in green bonds and what are the implications of funding those types of projects.
Great. Can I ask just a quick question but before we move on into a little bit more detail about green bonds? In terms of investors thinking about their impact, are you seeing a growth and maybe a correlated growth in terms of the interest in sustainability, but a growth in investors having more cognizance of their the impact of their investors, or are they still looking at a financial return element to it?
No, I think definitely the momentum is to think about externalities. And you know, you could argue that every investment you make has impact. And so even when you're looking at simple things like an ESG screen and not investing in a certain sector that you find either offensive for, you know, for reasons that your stakeholders have, or you think maybe has, you know, financial risk associated with, that has implications for that sector if you're pulling capital away. But definitely there is more of a pulse toward thinking about measuring externality and putting those sorts of metrics on portfolios in a way that we hadn't in the past.
Okay, great. And are people using it as a PR exercise, really, to show that they're investing in this area?
I think there's all sorts of motivations around this. I do see some, what I would say, healthier peer pressure and some investors about, helping society achieve some of the goals that, you know, we've set either in the sustainable development goals and, you know, Paris Accord, et cetera. So there is some peer pressure there. But, it, you know, along with that, you do see sophisticated investors who really get it, who really are doing this because, they think that these are challenges they're going to be facing in the future. And they are managing money. I think as one large pension fund says, it's not just for this generation, for future generations. And so, so while it may have started as a PR exercise, I think the more educated people get, again, especially around climate change, I think the more seriously people are taking these topics and investments.
And before we get onto the green bonds, which is obviously very topical, just one of the questions that tends to come at me from advisors is, we understand that with corporate bonds, it might be a little bit easier to understand what's going on with a company from a sustainability perspective. But when you look at sovereigns, it can be more challenging. And I noticed from your research, you know, you say, look, macro factors like interest rates, inflation, those types of things can have big, big impacts. But now you're trying to look at the sustainable development goals and see if there's material factors that you can take into consideration to maybe offer a new lens on sovereign bonds. Is that right?
Yeah, so we launched something recently, which we call the BSSI, the BlackRock Sovereign Sustainability Index. And I'll tell you a little bit of the story behind this. We've been talking about the financial impact on portfolios from ESG risk, and we use a lot of the external rating agencies to help us with this. And so often in fixed income, you know, we're often asked, you know, how do we think about sovereigns? And, you know, quite frankly, I think the relationship, the financial material relationship that we have between ESG topics and company balance sheets, it's a harder leap to make in sovereigns. And, you know, I think you could have a very rich country that had very poor ENS, you know, metrics around it, and it's probably not going to make much of a difference in its spreads. And so can we make the same assumptions around that relationship with sovereigns that we do for corporates? And I'm not sure it's as clear the connection there. And so we started to really wanted to unpack for sovereign ESG ratings, which all of us use, what was really going into those ratings. And what we found was that, number one, a lot of the data was coming from the same source, which ultimately was the World Bank. And also, too, that alongside the environmental and the social metrics that were used for these scores, there was a high degree of reliance on factors that would indicate just basically how rich the country was. And so it really wasn't giving us what we wanted. And also when we tried to recreate some of these scores, you know, we were, you know, going to the source, going to the World Bank and trying to see, okay, where on your website is this data and how old is this data? And when was it last updated? Is this a metric that is, you know, consistently updated? And what we found was that it was a little bit of a black box. And so we do at BlackRock, we do a lot of work with the World Bank, especially, in the last few years around green bonds. And so we undertook this project with them to discover what metrics they had around sovereign sustainability, where to find them most accurately, were they going to be supported, and try to go about creating our own sovereign ESG score. And when we thought about creating ESG scores, we were going to think about what performance indicators are we going to look for? And the more that we tried to data mine and look for things that historically in the past have been financially material, we realized that relationship just was not there. And so we sort of gave up on thinking about, let's just find the things that impact the sovereign CDS spreads. And we thought about, to the point that clients are really concerned about the sustainability characteristics of some of the issuers we participate in. Could we metric a company's, I will say, good citizenship in the world? Could we look at the sustainable development goals and, using the World Bank indicators, think about what data was available to indicate whether countries were aligned with this mission? Were they doing things like educating their young women? Were they investing in things like public health? Were they following their Paris goals, et cetera? Mm. And so we created a new score based off this World Bank data around 40 different indicators, if you will, of the metrics that we found that the World Bank would continue to support that also were aligned in some way with the Sustainable Development Goals. And so we do have governance indicators in this score, but it's a third, not a half of the weighting in the score. And so what we came up with was a sovereign sustainability index that was not really intended to necessarily reflect financial materiality, but really to reflect a sustainability score, if you will. Now, after we produced this, and we had historical data on this, we actually did do some analysis of whether or not this was financially material. And we were pleasantly surprised to work with some of our sovereign credit research analysts to find that historically it had been material. And so while this wasn't the original intention of why we built this, we have found financial materiality in this index. And this scoring, if you will, is now part of BlackRock's sovereign credit models. Okay. And we're updating this on a monthly basis, and we're really interested to see how companies are moving. Just one thing that I would add on this is that, and we do hear from sovereign credit research analysts, that this data is very slow moving. So these are metrics that the World Bank will update once a year. We have added, as 20% of this score, a headline scraping indicator. So we call this our velocity indicator. Yeah. And we've taken some of the words that are in the metrics that we have been collecting from the World Bank, and we're scraping headlines. We're scraping news headlines around sovereigns to see if we can predict things like a Venezuela, if you will. And we can look at countries' movement up and down this index over time to see what it's telling us.
BlackRock is a huge manager, obviously almost $7 trillion under management. Is there an interaction that can happen with some of those countries to maybe help them improve their ratings rather than just saying, here, listen, you don't meet the cut and your interest rates are going to be significantly higher? Or is that for others to try and further sustainable development through different groups?
No, I think that, there's obviously, I think, more of an opportunity to directly engage with some of the smaller issuers on these topics specifically. But certainly, even in developed markets, you are seeing participation and interest in the themes, especially around climate. And anything we can do to metric that. I mean, I've had lots of conversations with large developed countries about where do they fall in our BSSI? And why they fell there. I got a call the day after we published it, wanting to know why they fell in this particular area. So it has definitely opened up some new avenues of conversation.
That's really interesting.
Absolutely. I think the black box stuff is really, really fascinating. And so in terms then of the reaction from the nations involved, has it been broadly positive? Has it been much criticism from it, is it making people take a different tack, I suppose?
I wouldn't go so far as to argue that we are having this, you know, this impact of getting countries to take a different tact. I don't think that's probably happening so much, but I would say that the reception has been positive. And so we have laid out our methodology document. And so there really is nothing that is qualitative about our assessments here. We have a rules-based system. The data is what the data is. And we sort of set it and forget it over time. And so what we're looking for is, you know, not penalizing, you know, countries that are ranked lower, but really looking at movements in the index over time and having a historical database to frame this conversation, I think will be really helpful.
Absolutely. And in terms of the data and gathering data around ESG is particularly challenging for a variety of reasons, but the headline scraping a bit is wonderful. It's wonderful to see it happening. But I wonder if, when you think about some nations that perhaps have a less free press than others, do you think it's worthwhile moving into sentiment analysis on social media or equivalent as well?
Well, we wouldn't be scraping headlines just from local news sources. And so to the extent that the media is picking up on any controversy, we will pick that up in the score.
In terms of the emerging market credit then, which is the corporate bonds in emerging markets, it was interesting to note that those with the lower ESG ratings tend to already be paying a higher risk premium. So they tend to have higher interest rates associated with those bonds. And my thinking then followed through to your framework, which is basically avoid or advance. So if you are to say, we're going to avoid these companies because they've got a poor ESG rating, and even though they're paying a higher interest rate, we're going to avoid them. Does it ultimately kind of highlight the fact that we need a massive cultural shift, because we almost need other investors to also say, do you know what, they are paying 2% more, but they're not meeting our standard either. So unless they change their get their act together, we're not going to invest in them either. So until we have almost like a massive cultural shift where all investors have this baseline standard and say to these companies in Mexico, Guatemala, wherever it may be, if you're not meeting the standard, you're not getting money from us. And that ultimately, as you guys point out, is your most powerful form of engagement, is to either invest or not invest. Whereas in equities, it's a little bit more complicated. It's very binary in a fixed income world.
Yeah, well, I think it's important to think about there's day one yield on a snapshot, and then there's return, right? Yeah. And so, you know, I think the emerging market space has been particularly interesting for us. We partnered with JP Morgan last year, or not 2 years ago, to develop an emerging markets ESG index. And this is something they've been very public with about, is our participation in this. And so we wanted to think about exactly that, changing behavior in emerging markets. And so since then, we have now ESG tilted EM indices. The JP Morgan, you know, they're famous for their MB and their SEMB. It's where all emerging market, you know, investors really use. And so now BlackRock has launched about 5 products off of this. And so we do have funds that are EM ESG funds. And this is particularly interesting because when we thought about the construction of these indices and ultimately the universe that these funds would be investing in, to your point, yes, when you put an ESG lens in this asset class in MB and SEMB markets, you do end up with a lower yielding group of issuers. And so this was definitely something, even from a commercial perspective, you know, how comfortable are our clients going to be in terms of taking a little bit of a lower yield on one of these funds to participate in ESG? And so I think, you know, when we came out with these funds, they did yield on day one a little bit lower than the non-ESG version. But what we have found is that in market dislocation, they actually outperform. And so not last fall, but the fall before, when we had the EM, you know, blow up, these funds actually outperformed by a significant amount. And so I think that instead of thinking about this just as a day one, what is my yield give up, you really need to think about as a VAR adjusted way of being in an asset class. And I think for emerging markets, I think what we are seeing, especially recently in this last month, is that an ESG lens is a way of limiting some downside risk. It may not be free. You may have to give up a little bit, but in market volatility, that these ESG funds are actually outperforming. And so it's not so much just that you give some yield to get an ESG lens. You just you take up maybe probably a little bit less volatile investment set. And to your point earlier about being a long-term investor, this is the type of return risk dynamic that you want to see over a longer period.
Yeah. No, that is interesting, because over time, then you can deliver better risk-adjusted returns rather than just focusing on yield day one. So we might get into climate risk, because just touching first on commercial mortgage-backed securities, because when people tend to think about climate risk, we think hurricanes, the impact on the actual environment itself, and then it's hard to kind of connect the dots between your portfolio, the various securities you have on. But I think if you look at mortgage-backed securities, it's almost the easiest way to join the dots, because ultimately there's a property underlying that security as collateral. So you talk about it as the physical risks of climate change on your portfolio. Could you maybe touch a little bit on that to just kind of connect the dots for people that are wondering, how is climate change going to impact on my portfolio?
Yeah, this was a theme that we were particularly focused on and continue to be particularly focused on at BlackRock. This idea of climate risk, I think it has, two vectors. We can think about the Paris Agreement, road of travel, where we have massive changes in our energy system and we avoid the majority of scientists say are looming disastrous temperature changes in our world. Paris doesn't happen. We continue to use fossil, unabated, and we go down a different path, which is, the path of 6 degrees, if you will, or, some of the IPCC RCP 8.5 scenario. And you end up with some natural impacts of some of these temperature changes. And so you're looking at things like sea level rise. You're looking at things like temperature changes. You're looking at things like increased amount of hurricanes and natural disasters and things like that. And so that is a very real scenario for us to think about. And so how do I get the scientific models and understand for my particular assets in the geographic location where I hold them in this year, in this scenario, what are the impacts that I'm looking at? And so this was a multi-year process that we worked on at BlackRock, which culminated in the publication of a paper, Getting Physical, which is available on the website. But we've been modeling these risks. And so for assets where we know the physical location of the asset, so to your point, a mortgage security, whether it's a residential mortgage security or commercial mortgage security, or for example, a municipal bond, or even for some companies where we have a pretty strong indication of where the physical assets are located, like a utility, we can actually model what the implications not only are going to be to the first order climate changes that we're expecting to see in sort of the business as usual fossil use scenario, but then we've worked with a climatology group to think about what does that do to crop yields in this municipality? Mm. What does that do to labor productivity? Does this building have windows that can withstand a certain, miles per hour wind speed in a hurricane, et cetera? And can we flag that as an asset that either is more exposed to this topic and we need to engage on, or we think should trade cheaper?
And this kind of comes back to your point at the start, that you were previously an options trader, which ultimately is somebody that has to be very, very clinical in terms of the pricing of risk. And these risks that you're mentioning, certainly from the reports I read, they don't seem to be priced into to the various asset classes.
Yeah, I think that I don't think that assets yet price this risk in. I don't necessarily think it's because the markets believe we're going, full stop on Paris. I think it's because investors have not yet had access to the tools to put some metrics around it. And that's one of the things that we wanted to introduce to the markets, is this concept of an easy way to metric this. Because the science is out there, the data is out there. It's messy data. And how do you take these climate models and pinpoint them to geographic locations and then map them to your underlying, QSIP? That's work that we want to help provide at BlackRock.
is this pandemic that we're going through at the moment, it's 1st of April today while we're recording, so we're in the middle of this storm. And do you think when we come out of this that people are actually going to be starting to look at these models in a much more serious way, that they'd actually wake up to the bigger crisis that is potentially looming?
I can hope for that. You know, I think right now investors are going to be focused on just staying liquid, right? And, yeah. and making sure that they have a handle on their risk. I think that, you know, hopefully what does come out of this is number one, this acknowledgement that as a global society, if we come together and move fast, we actually can make changes and we can solve some of these global ails, if you will. So I'm hopeful that that what comes out of this is a continued and improved focus on sustainability.
Yeah. So, I think you mentioned agriculture in terms of the physical risks there. And if nothing else, and if perhaps one good thing can come out of the turbulent circumstances we find ourselves in, it is increased attention on the supply chain and the vulnerability of the supply chain from farm to plate, if you will. Like from a climate perspective, and the absorption that that the agriculture industry can take is a once-off event. So, you know, one drought, one flood, whatever it is. But when that's a series, when that is one thing after another, that the ramifications of that are not known. So hopefully, and I don't know if you've any further thoughts on that, Ashley.
No, I think you point out the right word is vulnerability, right? And so, you know, this pandemic is a black swan event. We are feeling very vulnerable in it. I think there are some people that argue that climate is a black swan event. I mean, I would argue that it is a white swan event. We know what's going to happen if we don't act on this. And so perhaps our collective sense of vulnerability will help us, you know, make some changes around that.
And then in terms of the green bonds, which is a market that is growing exponentially and at serious speed, you know, I think one of the things that I took from your research is that by focusing on the use of proceeds tends to be what investors do. So if I think the example you guys gave, it was that if an oil company was to issue a bond, a green bond, it could be considered green as long as they were focusing on advancing sustainability. So you might touch a little bit on kind of where you sit on that in terms of, like, as you say, the greenness of the particular bond and the particular issuer that is issuing the bond.
Yeah, I think, you know, I would say that there are differences of opinions out there, but I think our view at BlackRock, and I think this is true for a lot of global investors, is that any company that has green projects should be able to issue a green bond. And this includes the oil and gas sector. I think that we all have a lot to do to transition. And the oil and gas sector is going to be the sector that is most important to us in enabling this transition. And so certainly we want to fund that and we want to help companies transition. And the green bond is an opportunity for investors to help fund the transition. And so if you are an oil and gas company and you have projects like renewables projects, that's something we want to see in green bonds. What we probably don't want to see out of a green bond is maybe an energy efficiency upgrade to existing fossil. Anything that prolongs the life of fossil is not something that we want to see in the green bond market. What we're driving at with this is the philosophy around 2 degrees and being climate neutral by 2050. And so if you're building new fossil infrastructure that's going to be in existence and by that date, this is not something that's aligned with 2 degrees. So, you know, you are really seeing a big difference in the way that some of these companies are approaching this. You have certain oil and gas companies that are really leaning into this, talking about their scope 3 emissions, talking about investing in electricity and renewables, et cetera, and others that are just, you know, again, business as usual. And so, so I think that, that, you know, for companies, we wouldn't want to see a company that, you know, from their business model was just absolutely 100% business as usual. They wouldn't have the green projects anyways. But certainly there's a home for anyone with good green projects in the space. And at BlackRock, you know, we used to have, our approach to green bonds was quite binary. And so it was, yes, it was a green bond, no, it wasn't. And still in the way that we record green bonds, we do have a list, you know, a yes or no list. Does it get a check? Is it a qualifying green bonds? And there are certain minimum standards that has to meet that. But I think there've been enough of different types of projects in the green bond market that we're now able to differentiate. And so we've rolled out a shading of green bonds. And so for each green bond that comes, we assign it a dark green, medium green, light green. Oftentimes this is driven by our view of how aligned is it transition. But it really helps us understand of, you know, there's so many green bonds that are coming, you know, they're not all the same and some are better or greener than others. And we want to be able to record that.
Great. And, you know, a 40 shades of green rating system is something that we might enjoy.
Well, I hope not 40. Three, I can process. 40, I don't
exactly.
know.
Exactly. One thing we're seeing in terms of the debate on green bonds in Europe is the inclusion of nuclear or not. The EU Parliament is due in 2020, by the end of 2020, to finalize the taxonomy of what's included or not. Is there a similar debate happening in the States, or is there something else that's dominating the debate over there?
Well, I think that you know, to your topic around on nuclear, there are some areas that I would say we deem controversial. Nuclear is one of them. The other is large hydro. And so in the green bond space, historically, what we've asked issuers to do is if you have a controversial project, don't put it in a green bond, fund it with a conventional bond, because there are a lot of different opinions out there about nuclear. You know, even, you know, some of the most advanced, you know, environmental experts, you know, think that nuclear is, you know, a strong part of the solution. There are others that it's anathema to them. And so we've asked for those projects to be funded outside the green bond space. On the EU taxonomy, you know, I think one of the powerful things they've done is introduce this concept of do no significant harm. And so, you know, my view is that nuclear is really falling under that category, is that, yes, it does have climate benefit, but the potential harm on this at current technologies, as we understand them, may rule it out as something that is included in the sustainability portfolio. And so, you know, there are other things that we can look at as well. Large hydro is one of them. We have certain standards around social and environmental protections that we want to see on projects. And so I think that was a really elegant way to address some controversial topics in that EU sustainability taxonomy.
Hmm. Obviously, you're a busy woman, so we won't keep you too much longer. But just a couple of final questions in terms of the outlook. The Sydney Airport recently did a bond where the interest rate is tied to the ESG performance with an independent evaluator. Do you think we're going to see more fixed income securities directly tied to that ESG performance? Is that somewhere where we may be going?
So I definitely think there is interest from issuers to look at this structure. I think that this is something that we see in the loan space. I'm not sure as a fixed income investor that I can, you know, for example, on the Sydney Airport, which was linked to a Sustainalytics ESG score, I'm not sure I can handicap what the financial price of that is. You know, again, there is no option model for that.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, we're investigating it. So I sit on the executive committee for the Green Bond Principles, which I would say is sort of the governing body, if you will, quote in quotes, of the green bond market. And we're definitely looking at this. We've seen a handful of these bonds. We haven't seen a lot of them. You know, I think, you know, for us, the green bond structure, the green bond use of proceeds structure is something that really works and resonates with clients. We get a lot of transparency on it. You know, we'd have to think about in terms of making that an asset class like we have for green bonds, you know, what would be the minimum standards? You know, what would be the types of links that we're looking for? What are the minimum, you know, coupon steps that we'd be looking for, et cetera? Not sure we get to that. But I think we're open to looking at anything that's innovative that really is helping companies transition and giving us, you know, some more information about what their business plans look like.
And, you know, we mentioned Paris at the start. We've obviously got the 2030 Sustainable Development Goals. We're 5 years in. Are you glass half full or glass half empty in terms of where we're going to go at 2030 in terms of reaching those objectives? Because they're fairly ambitious objectives. We seem to be behind already. So do you think we can pull it off?
Well, I definitely am glass half full about ESG becoming more mainstream. Yeah. I think it's no longer a niche issue. I think that... is part of investing. Having an ESG lens is just investing, period. And so, you know, as these topics become more financial material, I think that they, you know, we may look back and say, oh, remember when ESG was a separate fund and a separate business?
Yeah.
We'll be moving toward pricing more externalities and getting more reporting and giving more transparency to investors about what exactly they own. And not only are the financial returns this, that here are the other externalities that are involved with your portfolio. So I do think that the direction of travel is toward greater adoption. The Sustainable Development Goals, we can hope for the best, and you know to continue to move in that direction.
Yeah, no, that's a fair point. And I like in one of the reports I read, it said our conviction is that ESG is a why not proposition. So I think anyone listening to this podcast and who are thinking about ESG, I think that sums it up pretty well. It's why not. You have to really start thinking about this stuff. Emer, do you have any final questions to wrap up this episode of the podcast?
No, absolutely not. I am struck by the listeners need to think about why not. But Ashley, is there one message that you would like to give to this audience about ESG?
That I think that that especially around climate, that good investing is really taking a serious look at these things and not waiting and learning to price these in and getting comfortable with the tools and familiarizing yourself with the reporting. I think anytime there's a new topic in the market, people are sometimes reluctant to change the way that they've done things, and that it's important to embrace this concept. And that there's lots of tools and methodologies out there and support from regulators in this direction. And so to dive in and to please reach out to BlackRock if we can be of help.
Ashley, thank you very much for your time. We really appreciate it. We know times are tough for everyone at the moment. The US is going through their own challenges, and we wish you the best in Florida, and we hope that everything goes well for you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the ESG Factor. If you have any comments or questions on this episode or the show in general, please email theesgfactor@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. This series is brought to you by ESG Ireland and the Institute of Banking. ESG Ireland is an independent knowledge centre focused on delivering thought leadership, education and the latest developments on ESG in decision making. Find out more by visiting esg.ie or at ESG Ireland on social media. The Institute of Banking is a recognised college of UCD. It's a professional network of over 34,000 individuals working in financial services and is a centre of excellence in the provision of specialist education and lifelong learning to the financial services sector. Find out more by visiting iob.ie.